Cocktail College is brought to you today by Tanqueray. I don't know about you, listener, but I'm one of those people that needs a mobile app to track my budget. And I'm going to let you into a little secret. I actually have a line item on mine marked Tanqueray. It's true, because I'm a gin martini drinker and Tanqueray is my martini gin. I'm not ashamed to admit it, I have a Tanqueray monthly budget. But it's not just for martinis. Now, I turn to Tanqueray for any of the gin classics because it always delivers on that classic London Dry profile. You know, Tanqueray's, it's not like a good friend, it's like a best friend, a dependable stalwart that always delivers. Now, if you're looking for cocktail inspiration, well, you know you've come to the right place. But if you're looking for something tailored specifically for Tanqueray, you should head over to www.tanqueray.com now. Because you know what, listener? When it comes to gin cocktails, you deserve the best.
Hey, this is Tim McCurdy, and welcome to Vine Pairs Cocktail College, a weekly deep dive into classic cocktails that goes beyond the recipe with America's best bartenders.
Most folks thinking of daisies like your margarita or your sidecar, that kind of build, right?
Except that it's not.
Not at all. The daisy is my favorite cocktail to debate with my staff because they'll come through and be like, oh, the aviation is a daisy. And I'm often wondering where that came from and like, where's the seltzer?
Paris, London, Tijuana, New York. I certainly didn't think our conversation on the daisy was going to take us to such far-flung pockets of the globe today. But then again, I'm not sure how much I'd really considered the daisy before this. After all, isn't it just the template used for such popular drinks as the margarita and the sidecar? Turns out, no, as you might have picked up from that there little teaser clip. Because since the late 19th century, daisies have taken on so many different guises, embraced such a wide range of base spirits and formulas, you could argue that bartenders kept using the term simply because they thought it was a kind of cool suffix. Single definitive answer you cannot expect, listener. But please do fasten those seatbelts anyway and prepare to plunge into the deep depths of cocktail history with Marshall Minaya, a fellow gin enthusiast and beverage director at New York's Valerie, Madame George, and Lolita. Oh, and don't forget to prime the soda fountain. It's an all-new edition of the Cocktail College podcast. Marshall Minaya, welcome to the Cocktail College studio. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
I'm excited to get into this one. And you know, much like the espresso martini and that old anecdote of you send one out and then suddenly three or four more people start ordering them because they see it. We had a recent conversation on Cocktail College that was all about the champagne cocktail. Is it a cocktail? Is it a category of cocktails? Can it be both things at once? Can both be true? That is certainly the case for today's topic, the daisy. Marshall, before we dive into all that, before we start dissecting, for anyone listening who's not familiar with daisies, what do you consider the daisy to be, or what is the daisy?
I think the daisy now is often lumped into a categorical cocktail of a sour modified with a liqueur instead of a sugar. It's kind of like how the conversation started for me, where I think that it differs from that definition to what it actually is the daisy, although modified with a cordial or liqueur, has seltzer water.
Right,
which is my biggest contention with the conversation of the daisy today.
And you know, spoiler alert here for the listeners, you know, this has been something, or a confession here, this has been something of a journey of discovery for both of us, I think.
Very much
preparing
so.
For this episode. You know, we both consulted the fabulous Oxford Companion. A couple of things in there blew my mind. The history and some paths that it took. But yeah, we're talking... Most folks thinking of daisies like your margarita or your sidecar, that kind of build, right?
Exactly.
Except that it's not.
Not at all. No. And I think that where we like started the conversation too is like the daisy is my favorite cocktail to debate with my staff because they'll come through and be like, oh, the aviation is a daisy. And I'm often wondering where that came from and like, where's the seltzer? Mm-hmm. And just because it has a liqueur as a modifier doesn't necessarily make it a daisy.
Mm-hmm.
That being said, I'm also super hypocritical in the sense that I'll make a wildly different cocktail and be like, this is a Manhattan.
Everything's up for interpretation, yeah. You know what I mean? And what I do find interesting, though, is, you know, when you look at a cocktail like the Sidecar, or even for my palate here, but I think my palate skews a little sweet, I think that the liqueur alone doesn't provide enough sweetness for balance. Typically Cointreau, right? You know, whether that's in the Sidecar or the Margarita. I know Joaquin Simo likes to do his rich Demerara for the Sidecar, maybe a little bit of agave in the Marg there. Do you find that to be a balanced cocktail? Again, is that me just being sweet on the palate?
You know what's funny is, like, I think we often talk about the ingredients of the 1800s availability, and I can't imagine that things were that much sweeter then. But I find that original daisy recipes are super dry. And I actually have a daisy on the current menu at Valerie, and I had to balance it out with sweetness, and I still wanted to keep it dry, and we can get into recipes later, but it needed balance.
Mm-hmm.
And the idea of, like, this kind of like a sour, if you think about it, of a three-quarter two, it is not just a three-quarter citrus, three-quarter liqueur to spirit, because it's not there.
Yeah.
Like, especially with something like a Curacao or Maraschino.
Yeah, and beyond that, and we're going to get into that conversation, I do have some theories on why that cocktail skews dry in modern times, and we'll get into that. But before it, you mentioned the splash of seltzer. What fascinated me is that that was called out in the Oxford Companion as being served up in a coupe glass,
yes,
but still having that little splash of seltzer. That is not a technique that's persisted, right?
Not a common thing. And I think with a lot of the different technique conversations out there, my immediate thought was like dilution. Okay, so if we're using the seltzer as the water to dilute the cocktail and balance it out, that would make sense. But in every recipe, it is also either shaken or stirred over like fine or crushed ice and then strained and still topped with seltzer. And then it kind of blends into, as time goes on, more of like a long drink, which kind of makes more sense, the ties to a fizz, than it does to a lot of the other cocktails that get tied to the daisy.
So let's jump into that history. Tell us, that fizz, it's a great starting point. I want to say we're talking around the 1870s. Where does this story begin?
Exactly, yeah. 1870s would be the time frame. The cocktail was not published in Jerry Thomas's first edition, which, sidebar, I have the first and second edition at my house, and I was scouring through the wrong one. And I was like, I know 1,000% that this is in here, and I know like exactly what it looks like on the page. And then I realized I was on the first edition. But yeah, the daisy is a, as in the Oxford Companion Guide, a sour sweetened with a liqueur or flavored syrup, lightened with a splash of sparkling water, and served in a cocktail glass, close cousin to the fizz, as we said. And like that drink, to finish the quote, is an American drink of the 1870s.
Mm-hmm.
So the first publication of Jerry Thomas's Bartender's Guide was 1862. No reference at all to the daisy. Although Brandy Sour is in there, which appears close. And then in 1876 on the republish, it does have the daisy. And the height of its popularity was in that 1870s, 1880s. And then it kind of fell off the last decade of that century and came back quick pre-prohibition. I think the thing that stuck out to me the first time I was reading through Jerry Thomas Bartender's Guide, when I definitely had no idea of what really I was reading. The measurements were crazy.
Yeah.
The references were crazy. I was like just kind of like a young bartender trying to like read all the old stuff. And now I can look back on it in like a different light. But I just saw Brandy Daisy, and my favorite bit was Brandy Daisy with its recipe, and then right below it was Whiskey Daisy, same as Brandy Daisy, but whiskey instead, or Gin Daisy, same as Brandy Daisy, but with gin, et cetera, with whiskey, gin, rum,
yes,
and then brandy. And so that was the thing that kind of like jumped off the page to me then. And even though then, like, I don't know, maybe 8 years ago when I first read it, it was still like not a cocktail that I was like, this must be taught, or we see it all the time because we frankly don't.
Yeah. And so even then, back then, 1876, we've already established that it's a category or a style of cocktails, right? It's a suffix. Also, little sidebar, but you know, you're mentioning like Jerry Thomas, that kind of everything throws you off. The hyphen between bar and tender continues to throw me off. I just wish that it wasn't there, or that we started doing that again. Can we just bring that back, maybe? I don't know.
We are either tenders of the bar or we are a bartender.
Right, exactly. And we don't tend to tend much these days. I don't know. This is too much. It's too early in the morning for that as well. In the Oxford Companion, it calls out specifically 1873, or 10 years prior to it being written about in 1883, right? I want you to get into that drink, but my math there is telling me that we last year missed the 150th anniversary of the Daisy.
I wake up with nightmares about the fact that we missed this conversation.
If I could go back and change one thing about last year, it would be that I would have celebrated that. But no, tell us about the people involved and also the original version, or what we believe to be the original version there.
So the Daisy is one of those cocktails, like many others, there is no definitive origin. In 1883, like we said, it was said to have been first discovered or created 10 years prior. At Fred Eberlin's bar down near Wall Street, near the Stock Exchange. A Billy Taylor to bartender Frank Haas down there with the question to create a new drink for him. And there came the Brandy Daisy, as recorded in Jerry Thomas's book, with gum syrup, an orange cordial, lemon juice, brandy, and topped with siphoned water, which I imagine would be like we talked about, it is diluted, and that siphoned water is not to create a long drink or a fizz. I just think that seltzer water brings a touch of bitterness and also makes the whole cocktail effervescent and more aromatic.
I find it really interesting that we have this, and this is definitely no shade on Mr. Wondrich and Mr. Rothbaum here, but we have these names. Fred Eberlin's bar. Yeah. Customer Billy Taylor asks bartender Frank Haas. There's no additional context given there. I saw the newspapers that he, you know, cited in there, or the publications that he cited in there as the reference. I tried to find them online. They're not online. I'm sure, you know, David Wondrich does more legwork than that for sure. I'm really interested in who these characters are and why they were of note, but great names. Then I believe Haas, of which Wondrich I think it is, writes that he makes a career off of this drink, which is pretty cool. The one that I read that he then kind of built his career around was that whiskey version, which is a really weird composition, right?
Yeah, complete deviation from what we're talking about with the Brandy Daisy. So Haas's recipe was with whiskey, lime juice instead of lemon, a raspberry syrup as the sweetener, and soda water. And as it says in the companion, I believe at least one other ingredient, which we could assume in this case is a cordial like a cordial or a liqueur.
Right.
As our assumption to tie it to the Daisy. Otherwise, we're just kind of looking at like a whiskey Collins. No.
Right. It's a bizarre spec, you know, the lime with whiskey, that's not a combination I come across a lot.
No, not outside of like your Bucks. Yeah.
And then the raspberry syrup.
Which was, I think the raspberry syrup actually was much more common than what we would attest to or like think about, you know what I mean? Like even like original Clover Club specs were either grenadine or raspberry. And actually a couple years ago, I was in Rome with my wife and we went to the Jerry Thomas Speakeasy, and we're sitting there hanging out and talking to the manager, and he was saying, my wife was like, I love a Clover Club. And he like was so quick to be like, well, depending on the season, we either do grenadine or raspberry syrup. And I was like, what a beautiful answer.
Wow.
But so I do think that those two were kind of tied together at that time, depending on the availability of the raspberries. But I do think that like in fixes and things like that, that the raspberry was more in the conversation than what we would think now.
Yeah. So here's where my soda theory comes in, or my seltzer theory comes in.
Talk to me.
you're right that a lot of the ingredients, like the alcohols themselves, I don't think there's any reason that they would have been sweeter. If anything, they might have been drier, right? Right. So it's when we start talking about that syrup component of this drink, maybe that was pretty sweet. And maybe that's where the seltzer comes in, just to cut that a little bit and bring it back, especially if, like you said, this one always containing at least one other ingredient, almost certainly a liqueur. Maybe you want to cut a bit of the booze down as well, or maybe it starts getting too sweet. I don't know. That's just my theory there.
I'm with you on that, but I was going through the bartender's guide and to find the orange cordial that's referenced in Jerry Thomas's recipe. And I have it here of 1 ounce of oil of orange, which I imagine would be like a old school saccharum, mm-hmm. 3 gallons of 95% alcohol. And then you add a syrup of 42 pounds of sugar to 4.75 gallons of water. And then you color with a saffron tincture. So that way you have like a yellow to beef up the yellow orange, which,
wow.
Yeah, sometimes when I think about the stuff we do now and it's like, this is the same shit they've been doing this like is, for centuries.
It's so crazy.
Like, I never would have thought. Sometimes I forget to like go back and look through those cordial and shrub. There's tons of shrub and cordial recipes. But I mean, that's a heavy amount of sugar. No, 42 pounds, but it's also, he's proofing down 95% ABV. With almost 5 gallons of water. So we would be down to like a 20-25%, I would say, around here with for like more of a cordial take. But even then, it's like they say dashes, but what is a dash then? I imagine they didn't have cork dashers or these like beautiful screw top ones, but like I imagine it's more of like a just kind of like a throw it in.
Yeah.
Throw it in.
A pinch.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know. It's really, yeah, it's fascinating to think about that. And again, also like maybe then the booze is slightly less of a consideration here because, you know, when we're talking about Cointreau being, you know, 40% and margaritas or modern day, what we think of as a daisy being much boozier drinks even than martinis when you work out the alcohol, maybe not a consideration for this one, the cordials. Does the second edition of Jerry Thomas mention the whiskey version? And is it also like close to what we're seeing in the Oxford Companion there?
So I think that's what I liked about Jerry Thomas's specs on his, because it's literally identical. Like that's what stuck out to me. It was like Brandy Daisy recipe that I read before. And then it just says same as brandy, but sub brandy for gin, sub brandy for whiskey, sub brandy for rum. Whereas every other book has a completely different spec on it. Like Harry Johnson's completely different, Charlie Mahoney completely different, depending on what spirit you're using.
Mm-hmm.
But I kind of like that idea of just like, same thing, your choice of spirit.
Well, you know, Wondrich writes that Haas made a career off of this drink. So I think it's maybe safe to assume that he managed to make a career off of it because he had this weird version, right? Have you had Frank Haas's Daisy, right? You got to try it. It's got this crazy, you know, it's lime and whatever. Like, I think that's kind of fascinating. I think the fact that, like you said, the stuff they were doing then, the fact that people might follow around bartenders or know bartenders by name, incredible. The celebrity culture that we think is, you know, only existed post 1999, 2000 in cocktail culture. Finally, and this is something where I need to put up my hand here and call out a friend of the show, Frank Caiafa, author of the updated, the most modern, recent version of the Waldorf Astoria cocktail book. We threw a little bit of shade at the Waldorf Astoria folks a couple of episodes ago where we were saying that maybe a lot of drinks had been, that they might have claimed some drinks. And that is the narrative, certainly among some people. Frank disputes that. I need to go back and do more research, but I'm saying, Frank, we're sorry then about that. But also the reason I want to tie that in is because it's a nice little segue. Frank's stance is that it doesn't matter who created a drink. What's important is who made the drink popular and when. So where does the evolution take us from there? And also, what do you think of Frank's theory there?
I like that theory. I think one of the things I like about cocktails so much is that we do reference who created it. Now, I do think in the 1800s, it was lost in the conversation. Everything was word of mouth except for these very specific names and characters that were apparently published and and that we talk about
New York Herald and yeah. things.
I think that one of the great things about cocktails and cocktail culture is that we're very aware of who created it. It's like the fact that Sam Ross's name is so synonymous with the paper plane and the penicillin and many more. I like that bit that we can kind of like go back to this, whether it was maybe some other bartender that was making penicillins more often than milk and honey was. But I like that we can reference back to those people. So I agree and I disagree. Mm-hmm. I think that like if you remember a place, I think today we remember a place more than we do the bartender themselves. That's like where we had this drink. And mm-hmm. I like that in a lot of cocktail books of today's era, it references specifically like who made it and mm-hmm. and what inspired it. But I do like in the bartender's guides, like Jerry Thomas was a nomad. He was a very nomadic person. He was all over the city, opening bar to bar. And I don't think he ever claims that he like created these cocktails. Mm-hmm. This is like a traveler's guide of like a compendium of a collaborated and kind of like compiled efforts of drinks and recipes. And that's why there's all these different editions. And like one edition doesn't have a daisy and the next one does. Mm-hmm. Because like clearly in that time he heard of the daisy. I don't know or think that he like created it, but he heard of it and then he put it in his guide, thought that it was good enough to be there and people should be making it. And I don't know if I got lost from my original.
No, I agree with you there. I mean, it's the same, you know, we had this conversation with Ada Coleman and, you know, the Savoy cocktail book there and maybe some of her efforts going overlooked. People just talk about the Savoy book, you know, that the writer maybe gets more credit because people are like, it first appeared in this. People associate it with writers. Maybe it's just easy to say that like the popularization is maybe more important when we're talking about pre-prohibition or 100 years ago, right? Like the conversation around popularization for those drinks. But it's very important to note for modern classics who made them because we do have that information. You know what I mean? And a lot of those people are still around.
Yeah, very true. And I do think that's something that is kind of lovely about today's culture. Like if you read through even the PDT original cocktail book of just like 300 recipes, like there's that little aside on every single spec that says like the season it was created and who created it. And then regarding cocktails, it references each one of those bartenders. And I know I run like Valerie as a collaborative program. So I always make sure that the bartender that, you know, although I may like help them get to the finished product, it's still their cocktail and, mm-hmm. and they get the credit for it. And yeah, I think that's I like that bit that we're able to reference these bartenders and they inspire us to create new drinks. And although I'm sure Phil Ward would never want anybody to know that he created
you know,
the Division Bell, but like it's that he did and that's what we talk about.
Yeah, and he's still around. Yeah, you know what I mean? So I don't know, hearing you talk about that collaborative process, it's very much like, you know, my day-to-day when it comes to being an editor and working with writers. The writers get the byline, rightly so, but we help. It's a collaborative process and it's fun. But yeah, those are their articles. You know what I mean? I'm there to give feedback and to hopefully help.
Exactly.
I love the fact, though, that this is one of these conversations. It's definitely going to be one for the nerdier listeners here today. I hope they like it. But one of the conversations where we get to dissect those kind of things rather than we're saying, okay, who did definitively come up with something? Like, it gets us talking about theories. It gets us thinking, if anything, rather than just maybe regurgitating things, which is great. What happens next when it comes to the daisy after that, beyond Haas? Because you teased it earlier that it kind of takes these two different paths further down the line.
It takes, I think its journey goes for at least another 100 years or more, actually. Mm. Like, when we end up into the tequila daisy and another conversation, which we could talk about yeah. after. But in the 1900s, it was primarily became a gin cocktail as opposed to the brandy or whiskey of Haas's recipe with grenadine. And then it served in a Collins glass over crushed ice. And now we're just into a fizz or a Collins. But I think what I really like is the Charlie Mahoney book, the Hoffman House Bartender's Guide in 1912. This is where it kind of gets into the different recipe per spirit. And if you look at DeFord's Guide, which is one of my favorite, even for me to like for a quick reference on my phone to like look up a spec. I'm thinking orange cordial, orange curacao, and maybe like a dry liqueur, like a maraschino that's been around forever. And then all of a sudden there is with the chartreuse. And I'm like, where the hell did this come from?
Yeah.
But it was often in the sweetener conversation was yellow, a chartreuse, and orgeat. But with the Hoffman House, the bartender's guide, I love that it, so brandy daisy, sugar, lemon, of course, but this is raw sugar or granulated sugar. And the soda comes in to dissolve the sugar, not necessarily as like topped with afterwards. This is just like kind of the old fashioned conversation. But then they do yellow chartreuse with brandy over shaved ice, and that is stirred and then still strained. So we're still in a cocktail glass. And then his gin daisy is orgeat or gum syrup with maraschino, lemon, and then specifically Holland gin, which was obviously in 1912 at this point, there is London Dries and probably New World gins at that time. So I appreciate the callback to like a Genever style. But this one is the gin daisy specifically is stirred over shaved ice, strained cocktail glass, topped with seltzer. So the brandy daisy, the only soda that comes in is to dissolve the sugar. And then the gin daisy is a syrup with a citrus and a modifier or liqueur topped with seltzer again.
Kind of going back to that original formula.
Yeah. And then the whiskey daisy comes in with a gum syrup and orgeat, same lemon, bourbon or rye, which I appreciate of that time. I would have just assumed rye.
Mm-hmm.
And then also topped with seltzer. And then, sorry, there's one more because like they all reference rum, specifically a Santa Cruz rum of very similar to the gin daisy. So gum, maraschino, lemon, Santa Cruz rum, stir, strain, cocktail glass, topped with seltzer. So I think it's strange that the brandy actually kind of loses that and is more of this kind of like sidecar yellow Champs-Élysées style of drink.
It's so fascinating to see that evolution. And I think this is a great point as well to mention in the show here that for those folks listening on Apple Podcasts, Apple now has this really handy feature where there's a transcription of the episode. Because I feel like today's is one that's packed with information. And if folks want to go back and reference that, Apple very kindly and very helpfully now does automatically transcribe things. So yeah, there's a little hack because something we used to do on Cocktail College, we don't quite do that anymore. I think the first 100 or so episodes are transcribed on vinepair.com, but now you can find it all there. It's in the app, which is great. Marshall, now for something of a more modern thing that it inspired, the Tequila Sunrise. How does that fit into the daisy conversation?
That one sent me down quite the rabbit hole last night. I don't know. Maybe, you know, I think I'm a good teacher, but then also maybe I'm not because like there's so many categories of cocktails that I kind of attribute to like super bastardized and we just don't even touch on it. Specifically like a tequila sunrise. But so the variation definitely would come off of the early 1900s one with the grenadine. But this quote-unquote daisy variation is tied to 1930 Tijuana with tequila, lime, creme de cassis, grenadine, and soda. So still no orange juice in play yet in this like 1930s recipe. But obviously the lime was there with the whiskey. Grenadine was there. And then it's just tequila instead of whiskey, which people were pouring into Tijuana during Prohibition,
right.
And obviously tequila is being poured. And the creme de cassis threw me for a loop.
Yeah.
That's for sure. But I can see where, you know, the color and the flavor of the cassis and the grenadine kind of playing together. And I would assume with the viscosity of that it would kind of make a sunrise effect, but I don't even think that was like into the conversation yet until later. But yeah, and then fast forward to 1970 in California, a Bobby Lozoff created a new recipe of tequila, grenadine, a splash of gin, which I always appreciate.
Same.
Yeah. like the juniper bitters.
Yeah.
Big fan. And a quote, a good deal of orange juice. And this is where the grenadine is added to sink down to create the sunrise effect. And as read in the companion guide, in 1972, it was served to Mick Jagger, apparently, which then the band took with them on their American tour. And then that really kind of like took off. So that also kind of goes back to like what we were talking about, that people are like following these bartenders or and these cocktails in that way. So you just have a global rock star, just every bar they go to ordering this drink, and everyone, I'm sure they're like, what is that? And it's an easy enough bill, but apparently then they dropped the bit of gin.
Ah, yeah.
Damn shame.
I love that idea of using, you know, like gin as a little seasoning. You know, Brian Miller likes to add 151 proof rum as a little seasoning to everything. Maybe we should be doing the same with Navy proof gin.
I'm right there. Right,
you know, just a couple of dashes of that makes everything better. Was that the infamous, like the Stones tour where things went pretty bad?
I believe so.
Where they had the Hells Angels as the... as the security.
Yeah. You know, I don't know 100%, but I think it would be then. And that just kind of makes it all that much better too. I didn't even think about that.
So here's a great opportunity to remind the listeners as well that our, you know, sister podcast, Tap Lines, hosted by Dave Infante, is very similar to Cocktail College, but through a beer lens. And he had a gentleman on there who didn't invent the pumpkin beer, but popularized modern pumpkin beers in the US. Not only did he do that, he's a famous photographer who captured all the iconic shots of that Stones tour. So folks, go and listen to that one. Phenomenal. Very interesting man, I'll say that. Very interesting conversation. But yeah, couldn't pass up that opportunity to show some love to Dave in the show. Are there any other notable versions of the Daisy or notable chapters in history that you want to talk about? Or is it maybe now time to start talking about cocktail renaissance era, modern days, how people are approaching this or talking about this drink, which we kind of got into at the beginning?
I'd say now we're kind of like in the conversation of the tequila Daisy at this point.
Yes.
And into the margarita maybe, because I'd say at this point, now with like Tijuana 1930s prohibitions heavy, and from what I've seen, like the Daisy wasn't a prohibition cocktail. It was very much so pre-prohibition. You know, like we said, the 1870s, 1880s faded out in the 90s, came back in the early 1900s, and then from what I can see, it phased out during prohibition. I wouldn't be able to attest why, but maybe it just kind of lost popularity. Maybe people were going for stiffer kind of
right,
angrier
yes.
drinking styles back then. And then, like I said, with this very loose Collins, like 1930s Tijuana Daisy, I think now we're off track. And
yeah,
I guess that is the Daisy is pretty off track. So yeah, next would be into the tequila Daisy conversation. The Daisy, obviously influential to the sidecars we discussed, and now the margarita. So the story with the tequila Daisy, again, not proven, all word of mouth style. A Kansas man, Henry Madden, co-owned the Turf Bar in Tijuana, claims to have invented the cocktail during Prohibition, told a reporter in 1936, "I grabbed the wrong bottle." And the customer was so delighted, they ordered another, and word of mouth spread. Which, if we could take a break on this, I've been bartending for quite some time, and I don't just like accidentally grab shit. Like, it's like the Negroni Spagliato conversation. Gin and bubbles, Prosecco, are kept in very different parts of your setup, even if you're not in like a today build of like a cocktail bar. I just don't believe you. I guess you could grab tequila instead of whiskey or gin or whatever, but I also kind of just like, maybe you were being creative, you grabbed a bottle of tequila instead. And I think that's fine too.
Yeah, I think that's a great point. And also, these stories are often told by people who have that accident some way into their bartending career.
Yeah.
This would surely happen to someone who's either tending bar somewhere they're not familiar with or early in their career, right?
Right.
That you make that mistake and don't notice it and the drink gets to the point where it's actually served, right?
Yes.
Also, just, yeah, you know, you become one with the space if you have a good bar setup. I used to feel that in the kitchen when I worked in kitchens where I would tweak my station the way I set it up for service, and I always trying to find new ways and would like geek out about things like that. I see bartenders on the bartender subreddit sharing photos of their setup of their station for the night. These kind of accidents, I just don't believe they can happen.
No, I'm with you on that. And I'd imagine, obviously, then, like the way that I run my programs are, there's a physical Excel spreadsheet that is an overhead view of each individual well and where every single bottle goes every single day. Because with building muscle memory, you can then stop looking down so much.
Yeah.
But I think even with or without that, like you said, it's like you walked into the kitchen, you walked into your bar, and you made your adjustments.
Yes.
Like my angle doesn't go there, it goes 2 inches over or a centimeter over. Mm-hmm. It's like that's kind of how everybody is. And I don't think there's quite as many like bull in a china shop style of bartenders even way back in the day, mm-hmm, as one would imagine. But either way, he says he grabbed the wrong bottle. We don't believe him. That's fine.
I got one final thought on that too. Yeah, because also like you design your setup so that you can pick up things without having to look at it, so
exactly,
that you know where everything is. I think what might be coming into play with these stories is also the fact that you don't want to tell a reporter, hey, I liked the idea of this cocktail, but I wanted to tweak it, right?
Right.
That's kind of like maybe you're stealing someone's idea or whatever. We're fine with that these days, right? We love the idea of riffs in Mr. Potato Head, but
yeah,
back then maybe people didn't want to be like, look, I slightly plagiarized this drink. A better story is it happened to me by accident,
right,
and someone loved it. You know, the drink just flowed through me. I was just the vessel for it.
But we're in the conversation of Jerry Thomas's Brandy Butt, right? Brandy Butt gin, Brandy Butt whiskey, Brandy Butt rum. Why not Brandy Butt tequila? Like maybe that was their thought process. And yeah, I mean, I guess you're right. Like it's a story you're telling a reporter,
yeah,
like, oops, this happened to me by an act of,
yeah,
who knows what. But I think like that is curiosity is what bartenders are. And it's like, oh, I'm so used to making, mm-hmm, this gin daisy and I'm in Tijuana and why not tequila?
Or also, bartenders are storytellers at,
yes,
heart as well.
True.
So, you know, if you spin a yarn, who cares?
Right.
If it's a good story.
Right.
So yeah, guy has an accident, comes up with a tequila daisy.
Oops.
What next?
So what next is the turf bar is then exclaiming home of and originator of the famous tequila daisy. My biggest question is though, then what recipe is he referring to? Because the way that we like to easily tie everything together is that there was the brandy daisy, the tequila daisy, the margarita, as we see it now with an orange liqueur, lime, a sweetener, which would be agave as it developed, and the base of tequila. Or is it with this raspberry or grenadine? The lime would obviously make sense there, right? Because
for sure,
in the original it was always lemon. Obviously lime is much more common in Mexico. But yeah, I mean, like I think that's a very interesting conversation that we don't have because there aren't these recipes available to us. But I would imagine what's in my head would definitely be more of like a long, refreshing tequila,
right,
grenadine, you know, warm weather kind of style of cocktail rather than a no ice, splash of seltzer, kind of like a drier cocktail. So
yeah.
But I don't know. We don't know.
But then, of course, yeah. I mean, that does bring us to the margarita, the sidecar, the preparations. Somewhere along the way, we lost the soda, seltzer. It's a shame. I would love to see the final version of this in print, in which book it last appears with seltzer, and in the up coupe serving rather than, you know, highball, whatever. But yeah, then we do get to this point where also, as an aside, sorry, I think the reason that we get to the point where we're like brandy Daisy, tequila Daisy, now we're just calling it the margarita. The margarita's a Daisy, it's a family of cocktails. This is a really nuanced story that we don't have the answers for. As an editor, as a writer, especially back in the days when you're talking print, every word counts, literally. So stories get compressed, they get simplified. And I think that it's much easier to say the margarita is a Daisy made with tequila and the Daisy is a family of cocktails that contains these things, rather than being like the story we've just told over the course of this episode.
Right. I think you're right in that fact. And it definitely reads much cleaner and much nicer that way, from Brandy Daisy, sub tequila, and then we're into different ratios and we come up with the margarita. But maybe also those kind of like what we would consider like lower tier, smaller town bars where margaritas are constantly topped with soda. Maybe they've got it right. Maybe they're just referencing old Daisies and we're the ones over here making Tommy's margaritas thinking we're next level. But
that is fun. It's a great point, and I've forgotten about that. And I will say this. If you have 20 minutes of your working day that you want to kill by procrastinating, head over to the bartender subreddit and do some Googling. There's a person, I want to say, who works at a Nordstrom Rack bar in a mall in a second tier town or in a small town, who was talking about topping their margaritas with soda and debating whether this thing is actually, you know, whether margaritas should have soda. It turns into this wild and big debate about bartending in department stores and all of this stuff. Go and check it out, folks. It's very interesting. Maybe I'll try and find that link for when we publish this
episode. I might just have to dive in there myself and light a new fire and be like, if we're referring to the Daisy. Yeah.
Reignite that one. Very interesting. If you are a bartender of Reddit, please do reach out, or a member of the bartender subreddit. We love that community. Do reach out to us, cocktailcollege@vinepair.com. Anyway, sorry, Marshall, that was an unintended detour there.
I think that's exactly what the Daisy is an unintended detour to where we've gotten now. Yeah, basically that's the 30s in Tijuana. We're unsure of what exactly recipe he would be making. But obviously if it was like the longer grenadine base, that would kind of tie closer to the tequila sunrise than the margarita that we're kind of used to today. But then, yeah, in the 1950s is when the popularity of the margarita really kind of put the Daisy grenadine conversation to bed. And the margarita, oddly enough, like the Daisy, still no record of proven origin. But where the biggest detour went in my research over this conversation was in the Oxford Companion Guide, is they kind of say, like, let's talk about a timeline. So what we know is in 1937, for some reason, we're in London now with the Picador cocktail, is a tequila sidecar variation with lime. So, but kind of more of the traditional Daisy sidecar with that style of build, with a Curacao base and a lemon and a sweetener, but lime instead, which is maybe why, like, when we're constantly building agave distillate cocktails and we just grab lime juice just automatically. But I do think lemon is in the conversation too. That's a sidebar. And then we're in 1939. Charlie Connolly in New York for the Cotton Club made a tequila lime Cointreau with a salt rim and a lime wedge. But we're still up at this point. And then it goes back to L.A., a Johnny Durlesser at a steakhouse, which opened in 39, claims to have invented the margarita based off of a patron coming in and asking to recreate a cocktail that they had in Mexico, which very well could have come from the Turf Bar. See, this is where the story just, it's so many what ifs, you know? But yeah, and then from there, it was kind of like in the jump back to the 50s is Cuervo is the one that really takes it on and arranges that they arrange an agreement with a national distributor of Young's Market, and in there becomes the national margarita conversation of they put a list of cocktails together with Jose Cuervo, and the most popular one, of course, is the margarita, and it just kind of then cements itself as the margarita mm-hmm. that we know today, which was tequila, lime, Cointreau. Although oddly enough, during World War II, to backtrack a bit, there was advertisements around the tequila sidecar. So I do think that it's constantly being called back to the sidecar mm-hmm. conversation, the Daisy conversation. But I think loosely based, adjoining the tequila Daisy to the margarita, back all the way to the 1800s and the Brandy Daisy. It's a long evolution of a cocktail with mm-hmm. no bias or basis of anything that can be proven other than just bartenders mixing drinks and people liking
using
it.
Using that name.
Yeah, going to another bar and being like, I had this Daisy like this. And it just kind of evolved and grew legs of its own and is a huge, I guess, categorical conversation. Mm-hmm. But I think it's all very loosely based, mm-hmm. and the Daisy is long forgotten of what it was.
I think the final big question mark on that conversation, or at least for myself here, is London 30s tequila,
right?
Question mark, because tequila has, to my knowledge, never been as popular across the pond as it is here. We don't have a strong Mexican culture when it comes to, you know, immigration or food and beverage either. Even today, where we see tequila doing so well in the US, just not there. So I don't know why we take this detour via London, but it's interesting. If anyone knows, let us know. This is going to be the point, though, Marshall, where I want us to commit to a recipe, which is very hard for all the reasons we've just covered, but I would love to get the Marshall Minaya take on the Daisy.
Well, we have now at Valerie on our like classic selection of our current menu is a spec that kind of calls back to what I stuck out to me the most of the Charlie Mahoney recipe with the Holland gin. So recently a new gin just hit the market called Moonbird Gin that was created and consulted by a friend, Phil Duff, who has Old Duff Geneva. And obviously with those ties, when it took this gin to the motherland, to Holland, and created a very Holland-based gin, simple botanicals, kind of like what all the great spice notes and citrus that we're used to. But they kind of discuss it as a workhorse gin. Anyways, so we did a Moonbird gin, Holland style of gin, Daisy, 2 ounces of gin, 3/4 lemon, 2 teaspoons of maraschino liqueur, and 2 teaspoons of simple, shaken, served up with a splash of seltzer.
Nice.
No garnish.
No garnish?
No garnish.
Nice. I think the no garnish is a bold move and I love it, especially when it's intentional. You always had the seltzer there in it just because of your prior historical deep dive into this drink?
Yeah, for me, the Daisy's got to be a splash of mm-hmm. a carbonation.
How are you adding that? Is that from a bottle,
we have a gun.
A gun?
Yeah.
Is that easy to add a splash? This is where my not having professional bartending experience comes in. Easy to add a little splash without, what, you know, going over the rim, overflowing, things like that?
We serve it actually in a large cocktail glass, so it's like an 8.25-ounce glass. So I think drinks like that, no garnish especially, where the aromatics are coming from the ingredients, right? Like no additional citrus or oils or anything like that, herbs to grab your nose. I think that's why the seltzer is there in a large cocktail glass. All the references were always a large cocktail glass. Mm-hmm. And yeah, when you go to drink it, you're going to get those dry cherry notes, the juniper, the fresh lemon, the warming spices from the gin. And I think it's like, in general, when you're tasting gin, and I drink it neat constantly.
Same.
But it's like if when you're doing a tasting of a gin, it's kind of like first sip blows your palate, second sip opens it up, and you kind of get more of those botanical notes. And then if you add a splash of seltzer or tonic, those the carbonation, the bubbles, the effervescent is going to open up the botanicals even more. So I think that splash of seltzer is it. Mm-hmm. It makes the drink
nice. Got a little gin sidebar here for us before we continue. What ABV is that gin, by the way?
Off the top of my head, minimally 43, in the 43, 44 range.
Mm-hmm. We speak a lot about certain brands who have gone down in recent years. Question for you here, though. Are you familiar with why so many gin bottles from the UK are colored?
The bottles themselves are colored?
Mm-hmm.
Familiar with, no, but I would assume the fact that, like, although it's a distilled spirit, like, it they do age in glass, and with sunlight then would affect it, would be my guess.
So, and I got to give a shout out here to Brian Fakwat. I'm sorry if I'm mispronouncing your surname, Brian. Wonderful distiller up at Do Good Spirits. He stopped by recently to share his new product.
It's Staple Gin.
Phenomenal gin. I really, really love it. Check out our top gins roundup recently on VinePair to read more about that. But with the conversation with Brian, he was telling me that historically in the UK, a lot of gins are going to be above 45. And above 45, if you're not chill filtering, you're maintaining
yes.
a lot of the oils and whatnot. And yeah, fatty acids, I think, would be in there where a lot of the flavor comes from. So these brands would historically color their bottles so that you're not seeing that. Now, of course, as the ABVs have come down below that, not the case, or maybe some brands are chill filtering as well. But I found that one to be fascinating. Also, Gordon's Gin, as I grew up knowing it in the UK, was a green bottle, not like it is.
Not the clear one, no.
Not the clear one that it is here.
It's funny, actually, that you bring up Brian. He called me last week and we were talking, and I, the first time I had the great spirits at Do Good Spirits, formerly Prohibition Distillery in the Catskills here in New York, that was my conversation with him. He's, I'm tasting through everything and everything's sitting at 43, and he's like, well, you know, we don't chill filter, so it has to be above 43.
It's the 43 mark, yeah. Not the 45. Thank you.
And then it brought me to, I had a bottle of Stray Dog from Greece that was on my home bar for quite some time, and it literally started to, like, crystallize, I guess we would say, the bottle itself, which was the first time that I don't know, maybe this first time I had a gin bottle sitting long enough to notice it.
They definitely don't stay around for too long in my house or here at the VinePair office. I don't know who's taking them or drinking them. Marshall, any final thoughts on the Daisy today?
Final thoughts.
For today's conversation, before we move into the questions for us to get to know you better.
I feel like final thoughts would be, I'm glad that we had this conversation because it's going to change the way that I speak about the Daisy and educate my bar teams about the Daisy. I think that it will still be my favorite debate to have with my team because as we've gone through this like long story of the Daisy, we never once came across ties to what a lot of people tie now to like any cocktail made with a base spirit, a citrus, and a liqueur. Mm-hmm. Is kind of like how people are categorizing it into the Daisy. And I'm happy to die on this hill of you know, the lemon. It's kind of like the Jerry Thomas style of, mm-hmm. of the base distillate with lemon and orange, with the liqueur and seltzer, of course.
Seltzer, gotta be. I think that's really fun conversation, just as we know here at Cocktail College that the Gimlet is not a gin daiquiri. Check out that episode for more info if you're left scratching your head. But Marshall, we have business to attend to. Business in the form of question number one. What style or category of spirit typically enjoys the most real estate on your back bar?
I think as we've firmly established here, it is gin. Mm-hmm. I run three cocktail programs Here in the city, Valerie is a gin-focused program. We have just shy of 90 gins on the back bar. Madame George is a New York City-inspired speakeasy below it. So that kind of holds a bit more real estate of like of rye and, well, let's be honest, gin.
Mm-hmm.
And then recently opened Lolita, which is an agave and sugarcane distillate program. So that, of course, will be holding the most real estate there. But my personal bar, gin.
Mm-hmm.
It is, I think, just like one of the most accommodating spirits for cocktail builds, as well as just the more you think it's such like a simple conversation, but the amount of botanicals that can modify and change a gin, the ABV, as we discussed, the base distillate. I think the base distillate is like lately becoming one of my favorite conversations, from grain to grape to apple to
even whey.
Whey, agave. Yeah, Isolation Proof up in the Catskills is all but one of their lines is 100% whey distillate.
Yeah.
I have a friend in New Zealand that I, oddly enough, we grew up together and ended up in the same space but very different places. He's living in New Zealand on Stewart Island, just south of the mainland, started distilling gin. And when I asked what the base distillate was, he was like, whey. It's just in abundance in New Zealand.
Yeah.
It would cost more to import or to create like a neutral grain distillate.
I've had some great, I know you're not a big fan, but I've had some great vodkas from New Zealand that are whey-based.
Yeah.
Very nice. Very nice. All right. Question number two. Which ingredient or tool do you believe to be the most undervalued in a bartender's arsenal?
I'm going to go out of the norm here because, as we discussed before recording, I've been crushing Cocktail College episodes. And I agree very much so that the jigger is the number one. I think figuring out your jigger, your style of how you pour, measure or nothing. I know these seasoned bartenders are kind of like, if I can't free pour by now, what am I doing? But each syrup, juice, liqueur, spirit all have different weights and different bricks to them. And if your speed pourer has, you know, just a touch of use to it, the air could be coming in and out quicker or slower or whatever. And I don't want to poo-poo anybody's theory, but jigger.
Mm-hmm.
But my actual answer then would be a notepad and a pen. I know how easy it is to just like Google a recipe, or there's many like apps that bartenders create that you could search through. My teams all get the same information. There are long and many pages of classic cocktails and our house recipes. But anytime there's a new menu change, it is get your notebook, write down the specs, and it's just a memorization tool. Like, people come to the bars all the time and they're like, how many drinks do you know? And it's like, a lot.
Yeah.
But it's all just repetition, no? So it's as I'm reading it off of the page, as I'm writing it, I'm reading it off the page and it's in my head and I'm writing it in my own handwriting, which is a memorization tool. And then when I'm on the train and I'm flipping through my book, I'm reading it in my own handwriting, which is going to stick firmer than off of my phone. Mm-hmm. Or printed page. And it's just such a beautiful reference. I have like, you know, my wife could tell you how annoying the amount of books I have in my house, but it's like I have spec books that I wrote in like 2012. And it's just like, I love to go back to them and see how far off I was or whatever. But I think a book and a pen is going to be, as a bartender up and coming or not, that's going to solidify you into, you know, helping you remember how to build drinks.
I'm totally with you on that idea of, personally, I learn when I read something and write it down.
Yes.
It's how I used to study. And also anything that can take us away from our phones for a minute these days. Amazing.
Yeah.
It's getting too much.
Yeah. Agreed.
Your answer there also inspired, if I were ever to answer this set of questions, which I'm not going to do right now or anytime soon, what my answer to that would be. So thank you for that. It's not a notepad and pen, but question number three, what's the most important piece of advice you've received while working in this industry?
This is another one I've been thinking about a lot, and it's hard to come up with an answer because like I didn't come from like a known school of like a specific bartender or like
a family
or mm-hmm. A mentor is another one of my favorite conversations to have, because it's like held on such this high regard of like, you know, you had a mentor or you didn't learn how to bartend. But, you know, I worked with really hardworking, dedicated young bartenders that all imparted advice onto me that shaped the style of bartender that I am today and I'm able to teach. And then the true mentors would be the people we've been talking about all day, from Jerry Thomas to, you know, Ivy Mix. All their books are huge inspirations to me. But I would have to say, if I had to pinpoint it, years ago, I was at a point where I felt like I was bartending for a long time. I moved to the city and I had bartended before, but then no one would hire me because you didn't have New York City experience. So when that was still a thing. So I started bussing tables, from bussing tables to bar back, from bar back to bartender, from bartender to head bartender, up to beverage director or whatever title I would like to be classified as now. But I was at a point where I opened a few programs and I was frustrated. And yeah, I was bartending at some spots in the Lower East Side and just kind of like back behind the stick, which I love. And someone called me up, offered a meeting. Someone's looking for a person to run a program in Midtown. And this was offered to me by a friend who I've worked with a long time named Todd. That is a Empire Merchants rep. And simultaneously, Martim from Forge Gin. And they both had the same advice, which was, because my answer was no. I was like, nah, I'm good. They both said, you don't turn down a meeting. So I took a meeting, and almost, you know, 5.5 years later now, I'm mm-hmm. able and capable of running 3 programs and tons of support. Mm-hmm. So I would say, long story short, always take the meeting.
Mm. Great advice. Also, wonderful opportunity there to give a little shout out to Martim.
Yeah.
Ford's Brown Foreman, doing incredible work. One of my favorite people to grab a drink with there. We were actually just talking about the color of gin bottles not too long ago together.
I wish, on that subject, I wish Ford's would bring back their one green bottle per 6-pack was my favorite thing. Because we use all of their bottles as you know, batches and juices mm-hmm. and stuff like that at all 3 of the programs, and that green bottle, just like to stamp, say lime mm-hmm. is in here,
that's cool,
was one of my favorites.
Well, we'll put out the request yeah. with them. We'll see what they're saying. We'll get Simon on the phone too.
Dear Simon.
Marshall, penultimate question for you here. If you could only visit one last bar in your life, what would it be?
Tim, do you know how hard these questions are that you ask? You know what I've noticed a lot of people say too is that it's kind of like, yeah, it's a bar, but it's also a place and a time. So I think I would have to say, a few years ago, Jerry Thomas Speakeasy in Rome with my wife. We went 2 days in a row. And as a cocktail lover and enthusiast and absolute geek, along with someone that was in the industry for a long time and loves cocktails, but also knows how much of a maniac I am. You know, it's like she made this reservation, and it was obviously a renowned bar and program. And just to see their service, their flow, the drinks, the inspirations by the Bartender's Guide, a full bar built around this, no? Yeah, the cocktails were phenomenal. The ambiance was phenomenal. They dropped a little piece of focaccia that was from the oldest bakery in Rome. I was so full from the meal prior. I couldn't fathom eating it, but my wife said it was fantastic. but I would say I would love to not only go back to that bar, but to go back in time to go for the first time again.
Yeah.
And there's so many bars in the city that I would attribute to being one that I talk about all the time, or go to all the time, that I would say, but in a point in time and a place, I would say that.
Mm-hmm. That's a wonderful, I love that take on the answer, and that not only just the bar, but maybe even a moment, reliving a certain moment in your life. That sounds fantastic. Marshall, final question today. If you knew the next cocktail you drank was going to be your last, what would you order or make?
My quick answer would be a Negroni. It was, actually, let me revise. My quick answer would be a white Negroni. Suze is one of my favorite ingredients, one of my favorite liqueurs, aperitifs, and I love the idea of bitters were something that our body physically rejected for so long, and now it's just something that we have come so accustomed to, from coffee to Campari or Suze. But kind of tying in with the previous question too is, I felt like I learned so much as a young bartender by going to Amore Margo and sitting in front of Max Green and watching him work. And I would go, and my first drink every single time was a white Negroni with a different bitter. Like, just like I would just like pick off the bar top with this bitter. And yeah, a white Negroni is a beautiful, bitter, floral, vegetal cocktail. And whether it's up or over a big rock or warm day, cold day, I could crush a white Negroni.
I love a white Negroni. And, you know, talk about origin stories. You know, that guy just accidentally picking up a bottle of Suze and just making a Negroni one day and accidentally picked up two of the wrong ingredients. There is a wonderful origin story to the white Negroni. Go check out that one. Marshall, before we leave you, before you leave us, folks know where to find you physically on any given day, perhaps here in New York. Where can they follow your adventures online? Are you an online person?
I have the Instagrams. My Instagram handle is Marshall Vincent. Not to be confused, if you put in my full name, we'll bring you to a very mediocre photography Instagram, but there's no need to follow that. I didn't understand the ties of my actual name. But yes, you can follow me on Marshall Vincent. See lots of tales of the bars to my my daughter and wife and dog, and but lots of good stuff going on with the bars, and you can catch me there.
Fantastic. Well, you know, thank you so much for joining us, Marshall. Thank you, listeners, for listening, as we like to say there in the end credits. Maybe you don't always get that far. And if you don't, one of the other things you probably miss is our gentle ask to you folks to leave us a review and a rating on Apple. We're not just saying it. It really does help other folks find the show. If you get anything out of this and think other folks might, head over there. And hey, if you want us to cover a cocktail, or if you want us to reach out to a bartender we haven't had on the show yet, I know there are some popular requests there. Leave that in the comment and we will do our darndest to find them, to cover the drink. But thank you very much for listening. Marshall, thank you for joining us today. Let's go drink some straight gin.
Let's do it.
Cheers. Thanks for listening to the Cocktail College podcast. If you enjoy listening to the show anywhere near as much as we enjoy making it, go ahead and hit subscribe and please leave a rating or review wherever you get your podcasts, whether that's Apple, Spotify, or Stitcher. And please tell your friends. Now for the credits. Cocktail College is recorded in New York City and produced by myself and Darby Seaside, who also composed our awesome theme music. Just give that a listen. I also want to give a huge shout out to everyone on the Vine Pair team, especially co-founders Adam Teeter and Josh Malin, editor-in-chief Joanna Sherino, and art director Danielle Greenberg, who designed our killer logo. Finally, thank you, listener, for making it this far and for giving this whole thing a purpose. Until next time. Cocktail College is brought to you today by Tanqueray. I don't know about you, listener, but I'm one of those people that needs a mobile app to track my budget. And I'm going to let you into a little secret. I actually have a line item on mine marked Tanqueray. It's true, because I'm a gin martini drinker and Tanqueray is my martini gin. I'm not ashamed to admit it. I have a Tanqueray monthly budget. But it's not just for martinis. Now, I turn to Tanqueray for any of the gin classics because it always delivers on that classic London dry profile. You know, Tanqueray's, it's not like a good friend. It's like a best friend, a dependable stalwart that always delivers. Now, if you're looking for cocktail inspiration, well, you know you've come to the right place. But if you're looking for something tailored specifically for Tanqueray, you should head over to www.tanqueray.com now. Because you know what, listener? When it comes to gin cocktails, you deserve the best.